Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Let me give you a couple of interesting facts to conjure over. The health of Americans is deteriorating in international rankings. That's one. Second, economic recession, with some very interesting studies, appears to be related to improved health of a population. And the amount of money a country spends is not a very good determinant of the overall health of the population of that country. If you'd like to understand more about this and the reasons for these unexpected facts, why don't you join us as we discuss economic factors affecting population health with Dr. Stephen Bezruschka of the University of Washington School of Public Health. Dr. Bezruschka is a senior lecturer in the Department of Global Health at the University of Washington School of Public Health. This is the third time we've had him on Line One. His interests are socioeconomic determinants of health, and particularly how to draw attention to that so that individuals or groups of people can improve the situation. Dr. Bezruschka, welcome to Line One again.
Thank you very much for having me, Dr. Woodard.
Let me remind listeners again, also, if you've got questions or comments throughout the next hour, you can reach us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, so Stephen, let's just start with the basics a little bit. What do we mean by population health? And I know you want to, so let's compare that with what do we mean by health and health care in particular.
So health is a very nebulous term to try and define. World Health Organization in 1947-48 said health is a state of complete mental, physical, and social well-being and not merely the absence of disease. So that's very hard to operationalize. I think of population health as a measure of the health of a population, and that is based usually on mortality measures. That is, as a former ER doc, the easiest thing for me to figure out was whether somebody was alive or dead. So let's just use death rates as a measure of health and not dying being better than dying. So life expectancy, infant mortality, child mortality, mortality in the prime of life, all those are data that are, those measures are recorded, because all we need to know them is when somebody's born and when they die. And all rich countries do that. So it gives us good things to compare. Medical care, health care, that's sort of what doctors, nurses, physicians, assistants, all these people do. It's what they're trained to do. There's an assumption that because we call it health care, it must produce health. But I prefer to ask the question, do you want health or health care? Because the two represent quite distinctive concepts.
And what do we know about the determinants then of the health of a population? What makes the U.S. health of a population have X and Cuba Y and Greece Z?
So that's complex. I mean, for me to give you a simplistic answer, most people would say, oh, he's trying to oversimplify. But at the risk of doing that, it turns out that the nature of social relationships in a population, how much they support one another, are very important determinants of the health of a population. The way a society structures early life, that is, we've learned that as much as half of our health as adults, actually one of the residents in the program that I did, family practice residents today, said 70% of our health is determined in the first 1,000 days, that is beginning with conception to about age 2. We don't know if it's that high, but it's certainly not 5 or 10%. So it's close to about half. So half of our health is determined before, while we're from conception to certainly before we go to school, while we're sort of still toddling around. So societies that are healthier tend to have something going on in that period that facilitates good health. Medical care, by any estimate, has a relatively limited impact on the health of societies, at least in rich countries where it's been studied. In order, it's hard for me to put a percentage on it. There are studies suggesting it doesn't have much of any impact, and most people don't want to give that any credence, but certainly much less than the things I've mentioned, early life and social factors. Mm-hmm.
I guess I should not leave this idea of early life factors having long-term health consequences. It's a very, very interesting area of research. Could you just flesh that out just a little bit more for listeners, because I'm sure that might be on their mind?
So, we spend the first 9 months inside our mother. The ovum, the egg that was fertilized, actually your mother made in your maternal grandmother's womb. Because women are born with all the ova they will ever have. So, in a sense, you started life in your maternal grandmother's womb. People always ask me, what about the father, the grandfather? I can't visualize that as clearly as I can with this. So, your grandparents' health is important for your health. Your parents, their health is important for your health. You see it most clearly through the maternal line. That fertilized egg divides roughly 42 times inside your mother to produce a newborn. Then there's another further five cycles of cell division outside the uterus. And cell division is a very sensitive period that's very influenced by a host of factors, nutritional, environmental, pollutants, stress. And, take the first, the first 42 is just many more things happening very quickly and so potentially very influenceable than the next five over a few decades.
Hmm.
So that period is critical, and what we are learning is that societies that are healthier have the period of pregnancy to be one that's under less stress than a lot of the situations in the United States. And parenting, it turns out to be very important. That is the reason why it's called parenting. It's good for you. So societies that allow people time to parent tend to do better than the United States. That's not to say that you can't have a bad 9 months or 5 months or whatever period in your mother's womb and have horrible parenting and still live a long and healthy life. It's just that the chances of that happening are much less than if the situation is good in the beginning.
Okay. You have a caller already, and I think I should probably go ahead and take his call. Steve, you're on line one?
Yes. I heard the teaser this morning, and this is an area that I've put a lot of thought in over my years, and I have come to realize that effectively, after World War II, when manufacturing brought health insurance bones into the workplace, that those people, after suffering through the war, didn't really use their care that much. And in turn, their children and grandchildren saw them dying off for some kind of silly reasons and started going into it more. Well, by then, the health industry had been taken over basically pretty thoroughly by insurance, who were like, whoa, wait a minute, we're not spending this kind of money. And at the same time, the FDA, which had been in the 70s and 80s emasculated by lobbyists so that they could no longer even compel a person to change their socks, let alone anything else, to the extent where today the food produced by many manufacturers has so many petrochemicals and other harmful additives put into it. And I've looked enough of them up online myself to know that they're there, that how can one have good health if one can't have the proper regulation to get good health? If they can't have the proper regulation that the cheap food they buy, because that's all they can afford because of the recession, which usually was hot dogs, which was just normally made of tidbits of beef, emulsified, added with a few spices and smoked, ended up with so much more in it today. How can you expect good health when you've got nothing but garbage to eat, and if your kid gets sick, the first thing the hospital says is, what kind of insurance do you have and how much can you pay?
Okay. Well, let's see what Dr. Bezruchka has to say.
Well, I agree that we need regulations of the economy, the societal structures. And I agree with you. You know, I was some about the importance of all the chemical soup that we're in, either what we eat or drink, the metabolites of so many drugs that are probably now in our water system that aren't taken care of by what happens. And it's hard for me to say that, to directly be able to prove that all this stuff is actually making our health worse. That is, to be able to do those kinds of studies, you've got to have people enrolled in studies, and you monitor everything that they eat, and then you follow them for long periods of time and see the outcomes. And we don't have those studies.
We don't have those studies because it appears that, for the most part, the agri-industrial businesses say, okay, this is good. If you don't use more than this, this is okay. So we're good to go. And they're not making the studies. And when somebody starts to make a study and starts to see, okay, there's some harm coming out of this, it's suppressed quickly.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. That is, the industry sort of rules the scene. They call the shots. As a medical student, I had this dictum: eat foods that spoil and eat them before they do. These days, hardly any processed food will spoil, no matter how long you
eat it. Myself, personally, I eat any food that I can pronounce the names of the ingredients of.
Okay, I go along with that, too.
If I can't pronounce them, I look them up. And
yeah.
That's where I was amazed to find out that organic foods had a xanthan gum in it. When I looked that up,
yeah,
I thought to myself, what?
What about the argument for both of you that we're living, you know, the life expectancy of Americans is longer than it was in the 50s, even though we may be falling behind other industrialized countries? I mean, it does raise the question as to whether or not our environmental influences are as dangerous as we might be led to think.
Well, they're certainly affecting a lot of biomarkers and maturation parameters. For example, the age of menarche, when girls start menstruating, has been falling just dramatically over the last 50 years. And are there sort of environmental hormones that are related to that? Certainly a lot of people feel that. I think that, yes, life expectancy, our health keeps improving, and it's actually quite puzzling as to why it has continued to improve. But historically, for the last couple of hundred years, there's been almost a linear improvement in the best attainable health, that is, life expectancy, over time. But which countries are at the standard of health for that time keeps varying. And the United States was close to the standard around 1950, when this gentleman suggested after World War II things were quite different. And now we've fallen behind. And you can make an argument that it's the food, it's the petrochemicals. It's just very hard to prove. And to me, as a doctor, all these nutrition intervention programs trying to prevent cancers or a variety of conditions by dietary interventions have mostly not been successful.
Well, personally, I believe that preventing cancer is a waste of time, because people now are living long enough for the cells to develop. And I would probably be more inclined to believe that it has as much to do with, like diabetes. Your mom had it, you probably won't have it, but your kids might have it, kind of thing, as much as anything else. Now, you know, I'm certain that there's toxins and carcinogens in the air that the people that are more likely to be susceptible to it appear to pick it up quicker. But then you hear of people, rarely, but you do hear of people that have been terminal for the past 18 or 20 years from cancer, and they're still chugging on. I honestly think that quite a bit of it has to do with the food we consume. I come from a family that one side was a bunch of farmers and the other side was not. The farmers all lived to be old people, and they, 80, 90, close to 100, possibly even 100, I don't know. And they pretty much grew what they ate. The ones that weren't, they usually made 70, 80. In the case of my father, he didn't make 60, but he died of overeating because of the effects of the first depression after World War One. Being born in Germany, he was hungry.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a completely different topic, and we'll just leave that there. But a lot of people today that live good, whole, long lives are either in a position to afford the really top quality foods, or they grow it. And the ones that are left are the ones that have to go to the grocery store and buy whatever's been genetically engineered, designed, or frappéed by some really cool, ingenuitive cooking guy into what looks like something really tasty.
Yeah, so
the wholesomeness of a doorknob.
All right, Steve, we're going to move on. Thanks for your comments.
Hey, no problem at all, and I can go on for hours if you ever want to.
All right, Steve, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
What about this issue, Dr. Bezruchka, of the amount of money spent on healthcare is not necessarily a good determinant of the population of health? That's kind of a corollary of what we've been talking about.
Well, if what I said at the beginning, social factors in early life are critically important for our health, do we have a pill for that? Do we have a surgical procedure? Do we have a scan that can address those issues? Not really. Mm-hmm. So by its very nature, medical interventions treat diseases, or at least they try to diagnose and treat diseases later on, that are manifested by situations in early life where they're programmed. So the very nature of the interventions can't be that important. Spending more might be, we have more disease than people in other countries, or at least it's profitable for us to diagnose disease. I mean, we live in a profit care system, so I often quip to people, if you think you're healthy, you haven't had enough tests yet. we can find something wrong in everybody. And it's in our economic interest to do that.
Right.
So all that does is drive up the costs of care and doesn't address the basic fundamental or primordial causes of health.
So it's really most countries in the world have increased themselves economically. They've been more and more economically successful. It's what they're doing with that the benefits of those economic successes for their population that has a more profound outcome on the health of that population is kind of also what I'm hearing you say.
I think that's fundamental. So take Sweden, for example, one of the healthiest countries in the world. They spend more government money on the first year of life than in any subsequent year. That is, they recognize that early life is important, and if you're going to put your money where it's needed, we put it there. They put it there. We spend our money on people age 65 and older. Why? Well, they vote.
Mm-hmm.
If babies could vote, If fetuses could vote, we'd have a very different political system.
Mm-hmm.
And since they can't vote, somehow we have to understand the importance of that and put in policies, for example, such as paid antenatal leave. Moms who are working and pregnant should have paid time off. All the other rich countries give you paid antenatal leave. We do not. Some give as much as 12 weeks. Only four countries in the world don't give you paid time off to parent. That is paid maternity leave. Swaziland, Liberia, Papua New Guinea, and the fourth country is unfortunately the United States. So we don't put our spending, we don't prioritize that time and spend money for that period.
Training and thinking is to ask the opposite question. Are there countries where they're spending a lot of money on the early parts of life and yet don't have evidence of success of outcome? I think that's an important question to ask. Has that been looked at?
No, that's a good question. A few papers recently. Jody Heyman at McGill University, used to be at Harvard, has done a number of studies looking at paid leave policies and health of countries, and they follow the gradient that you would expect. More spending on early life gives you lower child mortality, gives you better outcomes for most things. Yeah, I mean, it's evidence-based policy, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But we have studies in this country. For example, California has a minimal paid antenatal leave policy. It's the only state, I think, in the country that does. And they found it decreases the amount of low birth weight, premature deliveries, and C-sections. So, there's a paper by Gundelman just out last year or the year before that looks at the California data.
Mm-hmm. Another way to look at this would be look at its smaller populations, like on a county level, or within the states, and see differences, as well as the idea that you had expressed before we came on the air, where you're looking at women who are pregnant during stressful situations, for example, being residents in training in medical school, that their outcome is not as comparable, is not good compared to the general population, I think is what you were implying.
Right. No, it's... I haven't seen a study published on this, but it's certainly in the training programs, in the residency training programs, which, you know, there's women are now almost the majority in medical schools, and if not the majority, I don't know. I know it.
Right. Certainly in pediatrics, that's true.
Yeah. And a lot of them are pregnant and have babies during their residency. And we were talking about this one resident who's just delivered at a Swedish hospital, and she has to get back to work in 2 weeks, or she has to repeat her year. I mean, that's not healthy. That's the best I can say for it.
Let's flesh out a little bit more also of we mentioned, or I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that at least relative to other countries, our health rankings are deteriorating. We've talked about longevity. What are some of the other indicators that are often used to help us understand what specific indicators we're looking at when we talk about the health of Americans relative to other countries?
Yeah. So one that has come into use recently is dying in the prime of life. What is your chance of dying if you're age 15 before you reach age 60? WHO is now reporting this. It's sort of because life expectancy is a harder number to come to grips with, and we've all survived infancy, so infant mortality doesn't seem to be something that we're concerned about, or under 5 mortality. But if you're 15, for example, if you're a girl age 15 in the United States, you have a bigger chance of dying before reaching age 60 than a 15-year-old girl in Sri Lanka. Now, Sri Lanka is a poor country, and just off the southern part of India, and I'm glad for the Sri Lankan girl, but most people in this country are astounded to hear that, and they find it not credible. Similarly, if you're a 15-year-old boy in Peru, you have a better chance of living to age 60 than a 15-year-old boy in the United States. Again, I'm glad that Peru is doing well, but what does it say about our country that spends close to half of the world's health care bill, and we die in the prime of life more than people in these other countries? So that's a key indicator. If you're 15, what are your chances of surviving to 60? By the way, a similar indicator was if you're 25, what are your chances of living to retirement at 65? And a U.S. congressional report published these comparative statistics in 1993 and showed that we're behind all the other rich countries. And that's typical for any indicator you look at that is mortality-based. That is, we have higher mortality rates across the board for a specific indicator than all the other rich countries. And then, some poorer countries, we're not the worst off in the world. There's in what I call the Health Olympics, depending on who you look at. The CIA or Central Intelligence Agency puts us at 50th for life expectancy, but the UN puts us at 34th because the CIA recognizes tiny tax haven populations like Monaco and San Marino and places like that. So if you take those out, there's about at least more 30 countries that have longer lives for length of life. Infant mortality, the United States CDC, Center for Disease Control and Prevention, actually publishes comparative rankings in its annual report. And in 1960, for the chances of dying in the first year of life, we ranked 12th. That is, there were 11 countries that did better. In 2006, published in 2009, we ranked 28th, meaning there were 27 countries doing better. So I'm always interested in what does our federal government say about our health compared to other countries, and that's the only indicator that gets listed. They have life expectancy rankings, they have life expectancy for comparable countries, but they don't do the arithmetic and order them, which is unfortunate. It's sort of like going to the baseball game and just deciding not to have a scorecard. We all leave after the game and say, well, that was a nice game. Who won? Oh, I didn't pay attention.
Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to the Line 1, your health connection. Our topic today is population health and determinants of population health. If you've got questions during the next 30 or 40 minutes or so, our local number is 550-8433. It's 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And our long distance or toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. Another point along this line that has always been interesting to me since I first listened to you talk about this is the aspect of economic inequality within a country and how that correlates with population health. Again, I've gotten an email that seems to be confused about health of a population and health care, and I want to make sure we keep distinguishing that. But what about this economic inequality relationship to a population's health?
So first studies appeared in 1979 showing that more equal countries had lower mortality rates. And it was a study done in some 44 rich and poor countries. And it was published in some obscure demography journal and didn't get much attention. Well, since then, we've had about 300 studies around the world looking at different populations and looking at different measures of health outcomes and economic measures of inequality. And the bulk of them tend to show that more unequal societies tend to have worse health than more equal societies. Now, at the U.S. state level, that's a very strong relationship. That is, more unequal states, most of them are concentrated in the U.S. Southeast, have worse health outcomes, that is, higher mortality rates, than the Midwestern states, which as a group tend to be the more equal ones. That relationship tends to break down within states. That is, at the county level, take the counties within a state and see how income inequality correlates with their health outcomes. That isn't found. Now, that's partly, there's a number of reasons why at the small area, you tend to live amongst people close to yourself in status or type of jobs or wealth. We tend to live amongst people similar to us. So it doesn't make sense that you would find this relationship at the smaller level. It also is not as strong in countries where there's a big social safety net. For example, in the Scandinavian countries or in European countries, or even in Canada, which is nearby, where you have the government providing a lot of goods and services that don't come out of your paycheck, then your paycheck tends to matter less for your health than whereas in the United States, we're in a cafeteria plan. If you want something, you got to pay for it. So that's the nature of the relationship. It ends up that being so unequal as we are in this country is responsible for over 800,000 deaths a year. And so that's a substantial proportion, a quarter to a third of all the deaths in this country by this form of analysis called a meta-analysis, namely lumping all the separate studies together to come up with a single effect, shows that that inequality can be linked to a large fraction of our deaths in this country.
We've reached the halfway point, Dr. Bezruczuk. I'm going to take a short break and remind our listeners they're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. Our local number, 550-8433. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll continue to take calls and emails as we discuss population health with Dr. Stephen Bezruczuk of the University of Washington School of Public Health. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcast of Line 1, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. We're originating from KSKA Anchorage. We're discussing the measured deterioration of Americans' health relative to other developed nations and the economic factors that seem to contribute to population's health. My guest is Dr. Stephen Bezruczuk of the University of Washington School of Public Health. If you've got questions or comments in the next 30 minutes or so, you can email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. And those for new listeners, that's L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening to Line 1 between 7 and 8 on Monday night, that's a recorded broadcast. We won't be able to take emails or phone calls. Dr. Bezruczuk, we were talking as we went into the break about inequality, economic inequality, and how that is related to the health of a population. But tell us how economic inequality might be measured so that those listeners who are hearing this for the first time may be suspicious about that information, and that might be one of their suspicions.
Sure. There's a variety of different measures. You can take the ratio of the top 10% to the bottom 10% of income. Income is something that is reported pretty substantially. Wealth is probably would be another good indicator. This week, Forbes magazine has released its annual billionaire issue, and we have 35% of all the billionaires in the world. Our share has actually gone down a little bit, but the number of billionaires has gone up. Then there's a measure like the Gini coefficient, which is a measure of how far income or how far the parameter deviates from equality. There's one that's called the Robin Hood index, namely how much has to be taken from the rich and given to the poor to have a more equal society. Americans don't tend to know how unequal their society is. There was a study done by an economist at Duke and somebody in the business school at Harvard that asked a sample of Americans to consider three pie charts of wealth distribution, one in by fifths, by quintiles, one in which everybody was equal, each fifth got 20%, one that had a slightly more unequal one, and then a very unequal one. And they asked people, which one do you think would be ideal? And they picked the slightly unequal one. slightly about 47% over about 43% for the equal one, and very few people picked the very unequal one, which was the U.S. distribution. The other one was Sweden's. So most people tend to think that the inequality relationship in Sweden would be ideal and don't recognize just how unequal our society is. And the inequality has grown immensely over the last 20 or 30 years.
That's what I was going to ask you specifically. You've already pointed out that since the 1950s until now, our population's health relative to other countries has worsened. And so an obvious question is, what's happened to our economic inequality in the country in that time?
So it's really changed dramatically, and it's mostly changed. Like, for example, I mentioned this session we did with the residents this morning, and my partner in this, what he does is give people deciles. There's 10 residents, so each one gets a slip of paper with which of the 10 deciles of income are you, and then he has grapes and a cake and serves up the quantities according to their decile of income. And I'm there taking pictures because the people on the bottom 10, 20% get a slice of a grape, a tiny crumb of a cake, and the person in the top decile gets two-thirds of the cake, two-thirds of the grapes, fancy cutlery and, you know, fine orange juice and all that sort of stuff for their breakfast. And that is a stark, a visual presentation of how the inequality is, and the top end has really changed. That is, the ultra rich have gotten much richer over the last 20-30 years. The rest of us have had to sort of make do. The average wage has been flat for the last 30 years. We borrowed our salaries on home equity or credit card debt. That's what caused the crisis in 2008, rather than asking our employers to pay us more. And the rich have just said, well, we'll take all that since it's better for you if we get all the money. I mean, I'm being a little extreme in painting mm-hmm. that picture mm-hmm. of inequality. But early next month, the largest income earner's amount of money that he made will likely be released again, because it always happens around in early April. In 2010, the highest income earner made $4.9 billion. And that's a record. This next year, 2011, I anticipate it will be more. And most of us have a hard time understanding how much $4.9 billion as a salary is. I break it down and say it's about $10,000 every 15 seconds if he works a 40-hour week. That's pretty good. That's nice work if you can get it. And in the United States, we believe you can get it if you try.
We're always biased by things that have happened more frequently, but I'm listening to you. I'm thinking of a program my wife recorded for me on from public TV a couple of nights ago when Bill Moyers interviewed Dave Stockton. Dave Stockton was the Secretary of Treasury under Reagan. And he has written a book, and I don't remember the name of the book, but the point is he's making a point that we no longer have much of a representative democracy. Our capitalism is more of what he calls a crony capitalism, whereas the rich, certainly the high-rolling financial institutions, can now go to the Treasury or have recently gone to the Treasury to ask for things that none of us could ever ask for in bailing us out of this most recent problem. And that really it's not much of a representative democracy when this is happening. So it's not affecting this change is not affecting just health directly. It's affecting this whole country. I don't want to overstate the problem. I just want to make the comment that this was a discussion here with Dave Stockton, who was a Republican. Republican.
I remember him, and, you know, it was Reaganomics or Stockton's, you know, supply side. Just give the rich everything, and it'll be better for you.
Right.
I remember that very well.
Right.
I don't know what to say other than, you know, we have the best democracy money can buy.
Well, I mentioned in the introduction again this issue, which there's some evidence that during economic recessions that the health of a population may actually improve, which is counterintuitive for most of us. You want to expand on that?
So this is really a fascinating phenomenon that has been reported for about 150 years. That is, you know, there are these accountants, they keep national statistics. And in the 1920s, some people sort of analyzed the data and found that it looked like during economic downturns that mortality dropped faster than during economic booms. So this was reported in the 1920s, and it was so counterintuitive that people promptly forgot it and didn't pay any more attention to it. In 2000, an economist at the University of North Carolina resurrected this idea, and since then, there's an economist at a doctor economist at the University of Michigan, Tapia Granados and Christopher Room, the fellow I mentioned, and a host of other people who've done studies that basically say mortality is pro-cyclical, pro the business cycle, meaning that when the business cycle is booming, mortality relatively goes up, and when it's tanking, mortality relatively goes down. The number of studies showing this on a macro level, that is for the whole population, is really staggering, and they keep coming out, and we have a blind spot. That is, you find these reports of, you know, what's the recession going to do to our health? And they don't want to mention these studies. There was a World Bank meeting in 2010 that asked, you know, it was saying, what's the recession going to do for all these countries' health and healthcare? And they all said, well, you know, the use of healthcare is going to go down. And they said, there is a counterintuitive finding in rich countries, namely mortality appears to be pro-cyclical, as I've suggested. And so at least they stated it. But I'm quite impressed with how we don't want to believe this finding that has been demonstrated for actually 150 years. So why would business booms be bad for health? Well, think what's happening in a business boom. Everybody's trying to get a piece of the pie. They're working two or three jobs. They don't have time to eat. They're constantly stressed. There's road rage. You know, when the economy started to go under in 2008 in the fall, we have a big trauma center here, and I asked the guy who was director of the hospital, well, what's happened to the to Harborview, the trauma center? Says it's empty. I mean, it's kind of interesting because what you find is during these economic busts, there are fewer motor vehicle crash deaths. There's less road rage. People aren't rushing around. They actually drink a little less alcohol, some of the studies show. Some things do go up. Suicide goes up. But cardiovascular deaths go down. It's a pretty remarkable finding, and I think it has something to do when people have more time and they're not working too much, they spend it with their families. I've already pointed out that's good for health. And they spend it with one another. They have more time to be friends with one another and support one another. These are a host of the kinds of mechanisms, I think, through which the booms and busts of the business cycle translate into health outcomes. And they support the idea that if you have time for being a parent, if you have time for friends, it's going to be good for you.
We remind our listeners once again, this is Line 1, your health connection. My guest is Dr. Stephen Bezruczka of the University of Washington School of Public Health, and we're discussing health outcomes of populations and particularly the economic determinants of those. If you've got questions or comments, we'll be here about another 15 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And let me also remind our listeners to go to alaskapublic.org and click on the Line 1 link so you can get some more links for more information about population health. There's two of them that I've listed there. We've also got a chart of the CIA World Gini Report that's been referred to. It looks at the differences in economic health of different countries or economic disparity of different countries, and a YouTube video as well, Dr. Bezruczka, making some of the discussions you're hearing today. Dr. Bezuska, here's an email that I have received that I think is interesting and would like to have your comment on. It's a little bit lengthy. I'll try to summarize it quickly as I'm reading it. And the writer says, can you talk more about the role of social relationships in health? Seems to me we're more connected than ever these days. However, there's something profoundly wrong with our sense of security in these relationships. I recently got into an argument with someone about immunizations. The other person said to me, quote, even if the risk of an adverse event is very, very, very small to my child, why would I immunize them to protect another child? I responded that perhaps he'd hit the problem on the head with today's society. Somehow it's okay not to care. We've been kind of numbed out. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, so yes, we are connected more electronically. I can have this discussion with you. I was up in Anchorage in January, but now we're far apart. But I think the real interactions that matter are face-to-face, and electronic ones try to make up for that. I mean, we're all walking around with these smartphones and all these other devices to keep us connected and multitasking. There aren't direct studies to address this, but there's a lot of hints that it's the people working with one another physically, looking at one another, seeing their expressions, communicating in nonverbal means in addition to the verbal ones that we're using. I sometimes like to point out that we're the only primate, we're the only ape-like species with whites in our eyes. Now, you know, if I'm doing email, if I'm talking on the phone, you don't see the whites of my eyes. You don't see my facial expressions. You know, I could be a good actor pulling the wool over your eyes. But if we see one another, if we interact visually, I think we get a whole range of communications that are really important to understanding one another and supporting one another and helping one another. So I think that's really important. And without that, the sense of security is lacking. There's the big unknown out there. It's in the cloud. I mean, now the cloud is this metaphor. And everything about us is being tracked. Our buying preferences, you know, if you and I sit together at a computer terminal next to us and we enter the same terms in the search engine, we'll get very different results based on your previous history and my history. That's unsettling. So what about the idea of immunizations and the risk of adverse reactions and how that might be affecting us? Well, we are a social species, and we do things as a society. And if a society decides, like, for example, measles immunizations in poor countries, I think, have been really important in lowering death rates from measles. And that makes a big improvement in health there. But if a lot of people don't get immunized, then a wild virus can get in there and cause a whole bunch of problems. So even though it's important that you get enough people immunized so it benefits everyone. And I can understand people's, you know, there's a lot of fear around these immunizations in this country. But one of them, diphtheria, for example, in the last century, an immunization against diphtheria has actually been shown to be probably our most successful immunization in terms of averting deaths in the United States. And having seen diphtheria, myocarditis, and other sort of issues in other countries, it's not a condition that you want. And tetanus is another example. Whooping cough, you know, adults are now coming down with whooping cough because their immunity has waned. I think society should decide, well, what's important for this society in terms of preventing these disease outbreaks, and we should go along with it.
Yeah, my thought was, you know, just a healthier country is more economically competitive, has the advantages of being more economic than an unhealthy country. And then the other thought that came to my mind is that, you know, we are a very competitive society. We're not as necessarily as a cooperative society as other countries. And so, you know that may lead to some of our, or just our culture may lead to some of these issues where we're not as thoughtful about others.
Well, I'm not so sure that's a part of our culture, namely not being cooperative. If you mm-hmm. look at the mm-hmm. writings of de Tocqueville, this French guy who came over here in the 1800s, when Europe was an aristocracy, and he said, "Boy, Americans, they work well together. They cooperate with one another. They help one another out." And we don't have this in Europe. And so, you know, the form of society and government that we had here was something that they sort of drooled about over there. Mm. And you know, so what happened? I mean, they've advanced their society to be very cooperative. Sure, right now in Europe, they're running into great problems in the European Union countries. But they're going to solve this problem because they've solved worse ones in the past. I want to make one other point before we finish, or the time's over, and that is, health keeps on improving. We talked about that earlier. What has become apparent in the United States is that, and we talked about state-level health and county-level health, in a significant proportion of U.S. counties, life expectancy for women is actually declining. I think it's important to point this out. That is, from 1987 to 2007, the health of women, as measured by the length of lives they lived, has declined, has dropped in 30% of U.S. counties. In men, it's only in 4%. But people were predicting in the last decade that health in the United States was going to stop improving and start to go down. As a country as a whole, we haven't seen that yet. All we've seen is the relative decline, that is, compared to other countries. But this represents an absolute decline in a striking proportion of U.S. counties for women, and it suggests that life is difficult for women in the United States compared to other countries. That is, we have less social support for women. We have less financial support for women. Women are now the majority of the workforce because we can pay women less. So in a market economy, that's what's going to happen. And, you know, we men, well, not much more is expected of us. But for a woman, they've got to be successful in the career place. They've got to be a devoted wife, a soccer mom, a supermodel, a jock. It's really hard to do all those things. And so the competitiveness, and I've seen this among women, I was talking about this earlier, they're competing with one another and they're together not doing so well.
I want to mention just quickly, we have another caller, and we're in the last 5 minutes, and another email that came in. It just says it's time the public learned the facts surrounding our real standing in the world. When will our government catch up with this understanding, or do they not really care? My comment would be that, you know, you put in population health factors and you get some government, some information. The government, I think, is aware of this. Where I think the lacking is our elected representatives, and that means our population needs to be a lot more in tune to this. Bill, you're on line one. What can we do for you? Oh, all right. Sorry, he left us. So, Steve, I made an editorial comment there about that last email regarding that it's time, you know, that I'm not sure it's the government. I'm not sure what the writer meant by government. To me, it's really trying to get legislators and everybody to open their minds to the possibility of what may be going on in the last 40 to 50 years in the U.S.
Yes, you know, the government is responsive to the voters. The poor don't vote, and the young don't vote. And in the last election, there was a greater in national elections, there was a greater proportion of young voting. It's going to be interesting to see if this happens now. We no longer have the ability to become informed of the critical issues in our democracy. That is, we have a media that is no longer focused on investigative journalism. We no longer have government support of the media. Nichols and McChesney at the University of Wisconsin have written about this. You know, we used to subsidize newspapers so that they could be sent in the mail. That's how most newspapers were distributed in this country until after the Second World War. And so there was tremendous government subsidy of the media and the press. Now there's very little government funding. There's, you know, stations such as yours and a few others, but we spend at most $1 billion on government-supported public media in the United States. And if we were to do the same per capita subsidy of media per person, as, say, a lot of the other countries do, we'd be spending $35 billion on our government-subsidized media. So we'd have much more information, such as the material that I'm talking about, such as the impacts of inequality. You know, there's a little discussion in the 99%, 1% talk about inequality, but nobody makes the link to our health. And that's because the media is not doing investigative journalism to the extent that it should be. And editors mostly take press releases, and they don't send out reporters to find out what the story is really going on. And so our democracy is at stake for this, I would suggest. And the elected representatives, all they want to do is get reelected, and you don't have to cater to the needs of ordinary people and think about their health, because especially after the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, they have all this money that is coming anonymously from big corporations to fund our electoral process, and that's a disaster.
We're in our last minute right now, Dr. Bezushka, and I'd just like you to sum up the cogent points here before we go off the air.
Sure. So how is the United States doing? Well, I would say we can't know how the United States is doing without looking at other countries. Seymour Martin Lipset said, a man who knows only one country knows no country. So we have to see ourselves in comparison to other countries. And since the feeling in the United States is that we're the best, why should we look at other countries? Well, once we unpack that and look at other countries, we find that in most of the things that we value, such as our health, such as how we do in school, such as not having children have children, teenage birth, such as violence, compared to other countries, we don't do so well. And when you try to figure out why that's so, it turns out that the political choices we make on how to share what's ours determine most of those outcomes. And so if we want to take something such as our health, how long we live, our chances of dying, then we should understand that policies in early life that basically give parents time to be pregnant and time to parent are critical for our health, and that the economic structure of society, how we choose to share what's ours, are the key factors underlying that.
Thanks very much for taking the time with us today. This is provocative and interesting, and hopefully our listeners will gain from this. Our appreciation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Witter.
Why don't you join us next Monday afternoon, March 19th, when T.R. Reid, one of the nation's best-known reporters, will discuss the Obama Affordable Health Care Plan with us and other issues as well. So why not tune into your health and join us Monday, March 19th from 2 to 3 p.m., repeating the same evening at 7 p.m. on KSKA.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.